Welcome to Belt to Loda, the officially unofficial podcast for The Expanse on Amazon Prime. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 6, Episode 6, titled Babylon's Ashes. It's the series finale, or if you're British, what did they do? What do they do when they get their series mixed up?
They call it finale? Did they pronounce finale wrong?
They must spell it C-E-R-E-S. I think that's how they do it, right? The series finale is C-E-R-E-S. This is the last episode of The Expanse. We've seen it all that there's probably ever going to be, but, you know, you can always hold out hope. Aaron, what'd you think of it?
So I've seen this episode 3 times now.
Oh, Jesus, luxury. I saw it once.
Oh, really?
I just didn't have time. Yeah, I was moving all day yesterday.
I will say that I liked it, and I liked how it ended a lot. And I was satisfied in like where the crew were at. I felt like this was a surprisingly messy episode. Compounding some of the... I'll go out and say it. Like, I do not understand the purpose of the Laconian scenes. Mm. And I felt there was at least two other entirely new elements to the plot that are not going... And as I was watching, and I'm like, well, maybe this will... And I thought I saw where some of those were going. And then, like, you know, I thought there was going to be a Star Trek 2...
Yeah.
Wrath of Khan for one Peaches. You know, the needs of the mini outweigh the needs of the peach. But that didn't happen. So I'm like, well, what the fuck? Like, and it's like there's this thing. It's like, well, we got to do things. And they've been such smart adapters up to this point that it felt like, I don't know, maybe they wrote this when they were really hoping they would get another series extension. So like, well, we got to make sure Laconia gets established. We got to get Duarte, you know, evilly cackling up at his space station. We got to get Clarissa dying of space cancer. We got to do... What I felt like this also, at an hour and 3 minutes, felt like this... I felt like this needed to be 2 episodes. I felt like cramming all of the major battle sequences and the... what I thought was interesting and kind of amazing political machinations at the end.
Yeah.
Felt like it was a little bit overstuffed, especially with the continuing adventures of Kara the Explorer, especially with the stuff with Peaches and all that. Like, I just felt like it was trying to do too much. Having said that, and I also thought there was at least one head scratcher in like the action scene where I thought they were telling one story and then it turns out they were telling another. Now, that's unfortunate. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I thought I was delighted to see like what disgorging all of those cargo containers into the ring was all about. Yeah. I thought that was cool. I thought the realization of, you know, like following Amos on his like D-Day landing through this the insane shit that was happening inside the ring station was cool. Marco's last ace up his sleeve was cool, even though I guess he didn't get his final ace from Duarte.
Yeah.
And again, the final disposition of this series, I felt it does feel like the end of season 3, only more so. So that's what I thought. I'm curious. So I will also say that, like, if you're thinking, well, geez, Aaron is a little bummed, there's also, I think, a twinge of just, I am bummed that this is over.
Sure. Yeah. How could you not be? And love this show.
And because I don't feel like it's on the show's terms. I feel like there is more story to be told. The show is even laying tracks of that story. And it's just ending as satisfying as it can be. But I've been trying to do that for the last like 48 hours that I've been watching the show, is like try to separate the thing itself from my feelings about the thing and it being over. And I will cop to like being just a little bit like this is always going to be bittersweet, but it's also a little bit more bitter than sweet because I just doesn't feel like this show ended on its own terms.
I gotcha. Yeah. I've got a different perspective on this, right? Because I've read the book and this thing ends pretty much exactly how the book ends in almost every respect. I've also only seen it once, and I apologize for that. Like I said, I've been moving over the last few days, and I just have not had time. I had 3 hours. I literally set up a television and our couch in a room full of chaos, and I watched this thing. But I loved it. I thought knowing everything that they were going to do from the books really helped me fill in gaps, really helped me, like, okay, I get what they're trying to do here, and it works for me because I'm already familiar with this story. I don't need a lot of like I don't know, catching up. It didn't feel condensed, I guess, because I've had, you know, 20 something hours worth of experience with this exact story. So I guess I didn't have the same perspective on it. I do think the Laconia stuff doesn't seem necessary.
It's entire. There's no way.
But the
there's
thing.
There's no way you could argue it's necessary. It doesn't seem like.
No, the thing that it does is, I think, much like, you know, the season three ending or whatever, it gives you like a imagination for the future of what the Expanse universe is going to do, right? Like, oh, there's something more here. The story doesn't end here. I think they were successful in doing that, but I think it's very confusing in a season that was so short, in a season that sometimes did feel a little bit rushed. So I don't know. I didn't have a huge problem with it. Ultimately, I think it does kind of give like a nice off ramp for the books. If you want to like go and read those now, even if we don't get any more Expanse television or movies. And the stuff that they do really well, they did really well. Like those fight scenes, those battle scenes are amazing.
I can't wait to see them in full def when we watch it with everybody on Thursday night.
Dude, yeah.
Because some of that fast, you could tell there's so much going on, and with the kind of crappy 720 bit rate shit that we get on the screeners.
Right.
Like, it's a little muddy. I'm sure it's going to look a ton better. And it was already kind of jaw-dropping what we saw.
Yeah, no, that was incredible. They do little embellishments from where the books left characters. Like, some of this is exactly from the books. Like Marco's end is exactly from the books, and Holden doing the union thing, which I thought is a freaking amazing twist here. Like, yeah. They make Avisarala agrees to make, you know, the impartial dude head of the union, and then he just blows that all up by making Drummer the head.
Especially since I already saw it's like, okay, well, he's this president, she's the vice. So like, I felt like eventually
if someone assassinates him or something, because like, there are a lot of interest.
He'll serve a first term and set it, and then and of he'll course, be gone. But yeah. Like doing it that way was such a fucking ballsy yeah. bet on Belters.
It is, and I think he's right in saying like this is the only path forward.
I agree.
For peace,
I agree.
You guys have to take the punch. You guys have to give. Because they've been taken from for so long.
And honestly, that was one of the most gratifying things, is I felt like this show kind of like, I was actually kind of shocked at how it kind of tracked with, like, you know, last feedback episode, I talked about like my personal feelings on, you know, geopolitics and like what happens when you've got, you know, an oppressed people versus oppressors and who has to take what punch and who has to take the, you know, who has to be the one that, like, you know, is willing to take the first step forward to peace. And like, this is just that to the nth degree.
Exactly.
And like all, like I was just really impressed with all the things that Drummer was saying around the table. Uh-huh. And like the flipping of my word versus your word.
Yeah.
It's so good. And I don't know. What's really interesting is like, I'm also not aware of something like this happening, where the great, like in human history, where like a more powerful entity has just been like, okay, we're going to give you, you know, like we take over, we beat Japan in World War II, we take over the country, we rewrite their democracy.
Yeah.
You know, we impose martial law for like, what, 5 years, a decade. Like there's this slow handoff before, like we don't full. Whereas here, with, again, it wasn't all Belters, but a exactly. lot of Belters, half Belters,
yeah.
you know, were hated us enough to try to destroy the Earth. And Holden putting faith not in just that maybe slim majority of Belters who want a better future, but in Drummer in particular,
yeah.
and her ability to lead the people forward in a wise manner and be fair to all sides. I thought that was like probably the best thing, and the thing that yeah. I didn't see coming.
Yeah, no, totally. It's suggested at the end of the book, and I guess Michio Pa is going to be the one, and Michio Pa has been Drummer Peru. Has been the Macho Peru analog this entire
yeah,
season.
Yeah.
But now it's like really obvious. But Holden doesn't pull the trickery that he pulls at the end of the book, so that was like an added layer that was so, super appreciated.
Because Avasarala has this huffy thing about there was a 12-year plan. Was like, did they go into that in the book? And like, that's the what they're alluding to.
That maybe.
Like, almost like Dan and Ty is like, we're going to, we're the holden in this, and we're going to throw, you guys are the Avasarals that have read the book, and we're just going to accelerate that
thing. No, it was a lot of fun, though. And then there are a bunch of like, hell yeah moments, too. Or moments that were like, awesome with like Bobby and Amos on the surface of the ring station, whatever it is. And then like just a couple of really sweet moments. Like I love the juxtaposition of everybody gearing up for battle. And Drummer's like the one actually gearing up for battle. Avasarala's meditating. And then the crew of the Rossi's just having a meal. You know, that's their ritual, right? It says so much about these different crews, these different people, and how they're all preparing for the same thing in their own ways. And I thought that was just beautiful.
That's also carries
few moments like that.
It also carries on the like nostalgic theme of this season, because like Bobby wins the day doing the maneuver that we see her do when we first meet her, when she's on Mars, practicing with her squad. She tries to advance to an unprotected position to lay waste with her backpack missiles. And that's exactly, what she did. And I thought that, you know, like there's,
and then Amos coming in to cover her, and then the Rossi coming in to save both of them. It was exciting. Super exciting.
It was exciting. I don't, to me, not of reading the book, I thought that scene was confusing, because I thought they were telling a very different, so I thought they're telling the story of Bobby and Amos are going to give it all, because they've been talking about this for like, you know, why do we die? Or why do we fight? Why do we put ourselves in danger to save the people we love, to die for a cause that's greater than us? And they even talk about, like, Amos is like, you know, if I have to punch out, I want to do it looking at people in the eye. Like, I'm like, I don't know who lived or died at the end of this book. So I'm like, shit, Amos and Bobby are just going to get riddled with bullets. And it's a great moment for both of them that they've sacrificed. They've laid it all out to save the system, you know, and to try. But like, to me, they're telling a story of two people getting riddled with armor piercing ammunition. Like, does like Amos is like fucking Sonny Corleone at the goddamn toll booth. And then he just gets up after it. And he does. Like, huh.
I was a little confused by that. Like, okay, does he have like the second best set of armor out of anybody or what?
I mean, it was just blowing holes through like even Bobby's Goliath armor. And this is a complaint I also had about the last season of Game of Thrones, not nearly to this extent. Like, if you don't want people to die, then don't put them in a situation where, like, I'm just assuming they're taking lethal damage. Now, if you're going to do that shit, definitely do it on the finale episode, because you can only do that one or two times if writers check out on a seat. But that was like, I was like, huh. The music's swelling, he's screaming, his body's jerking as the bullets are passing through his body, and so.
Yeah, just put him in the auto dock. Put him in the auto back to
tank, yeah.
Yeah, just stick his arm through that hoop, and he's good as, right as rain.
Pull all the bullets out.
No, they were almost doing the opposite, right? Like, I felt coming away from that battle that they had sacrificed the potential safety of the universe or the known universe there in exchange for saving their friends, because Bobby makes the choice to blow up the reactor for the rail guns, which they needed to take Marco out.
Yep.
And that could have potentially lost the inners of the war. And Naomi luckily found a way around that. But yeah, I thought it was a sacrifice for their friends in that moment. And just hoping that in the future, you know, we can figure out a way to fix this.
It's what it came across, too. I feel like it was the correct tactical call, because you were about to die.
And right, then, and they would have still had the rail
strength,
guns.
You got full strength rail guns, and Mark was going to have, like, this time.
The Rossi
like,
guys, yeah. It's
at least, you know, you've got the hope that the fleet can get there before they can fix the rail guns, and maybe the Rocinante and everyone dies, but the good guys, broadly speaking, will win.
Yeah, it was a calculated risk.
Calculated, yeah.
And I liked it.
Well, do you have anything else we want to talk about just in generalities, or should we get right to the episode proper?
I'm ready for the episode.
Okay, we're going to talk about Babylon's Ashes, but first, a quick break. Okay, we're back with what is the final installment of the adventures of Kara the Explorer. I think I've been pronouncing it Kara, but look, let's go out with the right name, Kara. Kara the Explorer, fully pet cemeteried. What do you think of this scene?
A pet cemetery, her brother. She isn't. Well, she's kind of hoping that, like, I'll get pet cemeteried eventually.
Yeah, this is like, I'm seeing what's going on with these Zan. Yeah. I like it. I want in on it too.
Their parents don't like it, and I don't blame them. This kid is fucked up looking.
Well,
it's so unnatural. It's scary. I found
this very uncomfortable to watch.
Uh huh.
Because, like, normally I'm a big proponent of, you know, if there's this new freaky virus going around and grandma dies in bed and she gets up and she's, her eyes are milky white and her skin and her skin's gray and she's going, I'm not going to go in for the hug.
Uh huh.
But this kid looks zombified, but he's talking like they're child. Like, to me, this is the shit that would work on me. This is like, if a zombie's smart enough to, like, mimic my son,
no,
I will go into those chompers as long as he can be like, hey, dad, it's just me. I'm your kid. I love you.
So the only thing they really need to fix is the vocal cords.
Yeah, the zombie's brain has to work.
The speech center of the brain, sure.
Yeah.
Like, no, fuck that. This kid looks beyond help here. This kid looks fucked up, man.
I just thought it's kind of heartbreaking because I think this is Zan.
Yeah.
And he's a little kid, and his dad's turned a knife on him and then shoves him into the closet, and he's banging around clearly, like, you know, kids, like, getting... but also he's different because... I got the feeling that, like, old Zan probably would have freaked the fuck out getting put into, you know, and so I don't know.
He's weirdly detached from what's happening to his body.
And I don't know how much.
The emotion of it.
Because this also, you know, I think about Katoa, right?
Uh-huh.
And that he was recognizably Katoa up until the point he wasn't. And is this a tale of continuing transformation? Is this...
Right. I don't know.
You know, we get the viewpoint from him, and it looks very Katoa, like, you know, glowing brains and all that shit. I don't know. I thought she had a, you know, clever girl moment with the, and I don't mean like clever girl. I mean, like, you know, Jurassic Park clever girl, mm-hmm. With the data pad, fooling her mom and dad. But yeah, her, like, it's okay if I die. The dogs will fix me.
Yeah, that's, there was something horrifying about that. Something off-putting.
Yeah, the fact that, like, this
about
kid,
this child, yeah,
doesn't understand what this change fully means, and
right,
but yet has unlimited, like a child would, and like a unlimited faith in it, you know, like almost a belief in these. She believes in these dogs the way a kid believes in Santa Claus, you know, like the idea that Santa won't give you presents is just.
And she's not scared that it could be Krampus. Like,
right.
That's the worrying part, is the adults have a healthy fear of what this could be, or the, you know, what damage the change could do.
Yeah.
She does not have any of that.
Yeah. It's up on the rooftop, clip, clop, clip. But what if it's old Krampus coming down?
Yeah.
And then you see Duarte, as I thought, like, you know, just like, you know, just twirling his mustache and yes, at his battle career. Like, I thought that scene's dumb.
And we don't really get any insight into why he would be so thrilled.
Like, it has something to do with the response call.
Some communication with the proto-molecule beings or something.
And there's the cryptic, I have gods to kill.
Right.
Which is, like, fascinating, and I want to know more, but I'm not going to. And none of this, as we predicted, is important at all to the end plot of this season. And I just think I'm struggling to think, what did I learn here that wouldn't fit into just a sick ass cold open for a movie or a miniseries down the line?
Yeah.
Like, what, like, you know, they took a total of 20 minutes out of an already shortened season. Fairly short episodes to tell this particular story, and I didn't feel like it needed to be done. And in the end, I did feel like they had this push the step on the gas a few times. And I think for the final series, I would have serviced this story instead of trying to bootstrap the second one. But I don't know. Maybe Alcon feels like they can get the fans really hot and bothered for the stuff to come. I didn't think the stuff did it. To me, Like, honestly, all I needed to be interested in a potential miniseries for book 7, 8, and 9 is at the end what Holden was saying. It's like, oh, you know, we could do some anti-piracy work, or maybe we could consult for these new planets, or, you know, there was that protomolecules. That's all I fucking need to be like, hell yeah, I want to know what happens next. I don't need 30 minutes of this Saturday afternoon kid special that didn't do anything for me.
Yeah, I'm mostly with you. I was not impressed by it over the last 5 episodes, and this one didn't really change my mind much.
Yeah.
Though it does leave, you know, a season 3-esque, like, oh shit, something else is going on with the protomolecule. It's not just over.
It's just so much more.
Still something hanging out there.
It'd be like if they showed the settlers landing on Illus.
It's not the 2-minute sequence of like the thing, like, coming out
the
of
the ring
Venus,
gates
right?
going open. Yeah. Oh my god, how many of them? There's this many. What are you going, like, that's like a door that opens. This is a door that's open, and also we went through this other side for 20-30 minutes just to be like, hey, yeah.
Yeah.
You visited Narnia to see what Narnia is all about. I'm open to other arguments, and of course we're going to watch this again on Thursday night and see what other people have to say and see what the public thinks about it. But like, I already know that from my temperature reading of the fan base, people were not super digging, especially if you have not read the books, you were like, what the fuck is going on with this stuff? I don't think anyone's minds are going to be changed. If you liked it and you're like, oh hell yeah, this is really getting me hyped up for a potential series in the future, or I've read these books and I liked seeing a little bit of this get to the screen since I might not get it otherwise, like, I get that. But for the vast majority of the Expanse fans that are not coming at it from that, I think it's going to be seen as a distraction that probably should have been spent focusing on the main story. We'll see.
Yeah.
The Joint Strike Force Command ponders their tactical options as Marco splits the Free Navy into 3 fleets, all burning hard towards the ring.
Here's a scene that felt weird to me. The Expanse has done scenes like this before. I think of back when Aaron Wright was doing his bullshit, and there was always like questions of logistics of how are we going to intercept this ship, and what response should we have?
Can
to
all
this
of our railguns take out Mars's weapons platforms at the same time? Or
right. But those scenes always felt appropriately abbreviated. Like, it wasn't the real focus of the thing. This felt drawn out in a way. And I get this is a more complicated thing they're trying to arrange here, right? 3 battle groups. The Rocinante is doing its own thing. Holden has a plan.
Yeah.
He doesn't even like really tell us in this scene. We just see it later as to how he's going to distract the railguns. There's a lot going on here, and so they kind of needed an extended scene. But it felt to me a little out of place as far as like what the Expanse has done previously with these types of scenes.
And it's also very compressed because, you know,
that too, right? Weirdly drawn out, but also
you have to have drummer. You have to have compressed. The Martian and drummer instantly snap at each other. You can't have like a, like if this is a longer scene, you could have like a slow boil, or if this was multiple scenes of like them collaboration, where you could introduce some antagonism. But it makes drummer seem like both drummer and the Martian seem kind of unhinged. And then also Avasarala feels like which I know they're trying to not have a paternalistic take on the belt, but it felt like the old great society telling the 2 younger ones, you children, you know, like, I don't know. And also it suffered from a lot of repeating stakes that we've been made very clear the last 2 episodes. Like, Avasarala has to be like, you know, we have to do this because if we don't, Marcos will be behind his rail guns and in control of 1100 states. Like the exact speech that Renfield gave. Is it Renfield?
Sure.
Renfeld?
Renfield, yeah.
Rosenfeld?
There you
Krantz,
go.
Gilderstern? Yeah. If we don't, you know, it's essentially her speech only in reverse. Like, instead of, rah, rah, so what we got to do, it's boo, boo, we got to stop them.
Right.
So,
And they're about to jump, like, right into the battle. That was one of the things that impressed me this episode is, boy, they get to it fast.
They really do.
They don't waste time, And so, like, they have to kind of do it all here, because I think you're right. Previously, and in the Expanse, they would separate this scene into, like, 2, maybe 3 scenes, right, that happen over the course of an episode. They just don't have time to do it.
That's what I'm saying. Like, that's why I thought, like, this needed to be a double episode. I thought so, anyway. Or maybe an even longer, a 90-minute episode.
Yeah.
But, they outline... they outline the plan here and talk about how it's going to involve a freighter and the Rocinante and landing ground forces and taking over the railguns.
How the hell are you going to do that? Holden's just like, we'll talk about it later.
I kind of wish now, although I got to say that even knowing what happened, I had no idea what the actual thing was going to be until they did it.
And it was super cool. Like it's the only plan I can even imagine being effective in that scenario.
And
it's
such a great way to neutralize the advantage that they have, because like it's very Death Star. Like this is all designed for to repel Mars and Earth coming in with all their big battle cruisers and fucking shit up.
You've got maybe 25 targets.
This is the X-Wings launching against the Death Star because no one thought that someone would send 60 fighters against this thing.
Because it couldn't be effective, right? Like there's no way it would be effective. Yeah. And It's one of those things where, like, this is the only option. Mm-hmm. It's obvious in retrospect, but it's something you never even consider.
Yeah.
Asymmetric
warfare.
Things.
Like, they built big badass guns. We're going to have a swarm of small gnats that are going to overwhelm
them. Exactly. You. Yeah. I loved it.
Did you think Avasarala's like, is that the best you can do? Like, that felt weird. Like, what else are we going to do with this Corvette, ma'am? Like, yeah, it's our freighter and our Corvette, and we're going to do something crazy. What is this the best you can do? Just grab all your ships and throw them at each other? Fuck you, old lady.
Send UNN1 on the front lines here to crash into the other forces.
It almost felt like they were setting a joke, like, you know, she was gonna roll tough, like, this is this the best you can do, and Holden's gonna stammer and she's gonna be like, I'm super impressed or something like that. And they kind of got there, but I kind of wish they just left that one and just be like, you know, Jay, look, leave it to an optimist like you to come up with a crazy plan like this. Here's another one. This might be a screener thing. Did you think there was anything up with the lighting and makeup for Avasarala throughout this entire episode? But it's especially noticeable. Like, I felt like it looked like she's wearing clown makeup.
Clown makeup?
Like, huge disparities between the I don't know. And
was it the neck versus the face thing? Because I know that happens a lot. You got to take the makeup all the way down.
Usually is not. Show's makeup is usually pretty fucking amazing. And
I didn't notice anything.
It felt off. Maybe it's the lighting and this particular, you know, because it's a lot of like blues and purples, which are, it's an unnatural way to light people anyway. But
yeah, true.
I'm curious to see some of this if it looks better with the better copy. We're going to watch it with everybody on Thursday.
I watched through all of the intro. I don't usually do that, but I was feeling a little nostalgic, feeling a little like, you know, melancholy about the ending of this thing. And I watched the whole thing and I loved it. I thought, God damn, that's a good intro.
It's a good intro.
Great song. The graphics are beautiful.
They keep telling, like I didn't know this, but like they've slowly told the story of the railgun installation. Like, you know,
have they been changing it this whole season?
And I didn't know what the hell they were doing, but like they had their station and then they showed the station bisected by the things. And this latest episode, the railguns are there and they all fire off in sequence. Yeah. And I'm like, that's fucking cool.
Yeah.
And I guess if you knew what the hell was happening as a book reader, you might have gotten in on there. But it is a great intro, and it changes all. One thing I thought was really cool watching it in all in one go before the season is how many times mid season they change it. Like Mars having two moons, and then once is it Deimos or Phobos, whichever one got shattered, it breaks apart in, and it, to this day, when they show Mars, you see the one moon shatter and kind of drift into like a ring.
Nice.
It's cool. It's really cool.
And then at the end of that, they flip up the directed by credit. Directed by Breck Eisner, who I don't usually pay attention to a lot of this stuff with behind the scenes.
Right.
But I did note that he's been the director of every season premiere since season 2. And since Amazon took over with season 4, he's been the director of every premiere and finale. Also notable because you might recognize the name Eisner. He is Michael Eisner, former CEO of Disney's son. His real name actually is Michael Eisner, but I guess he doesn't want to wear his nepotism on his sleeve.
Yeah. No, he wants hired on his own merits.
And to be fair, like I don't want to disparage him too much, right? Like this is Amazon. This Disney has not touched this product, as far as I can tell. So you know, but it was kind of inevitable, right? He's going to be a director or a producer.
So not touching it at all is probably a little strong, but sure.
I mean, yeah. I don't, unless ILM's in there doing some of these graphics, but yeah, so that was an interesting piece of trivia. He has directed the series finales and previews for the last few seasons.
Interesting. Okay, before that, since now you dropped a trivia about the intro and the director, as you know, I love looking up the meanings behind the names of the ships. And this freighter, the Giambattista, I looked it up, and there's tons of famous Giambattistas. There's one that's a fashion designer in Italy right now. But the most famous one, the first result in Wikipedia, is Giambattista Vico, a late 17th, early 18th century Italian philosopher, rhetorician, someone is a master of rhetoric.
Sure.
Historian and jurist during the Italian Enlightenment. Giambattista is often credited with the invention of the philosophy of history. Specifically, he was the first to take seriously the possibility that people had fundamentally different schemes of thought in different historical eras. Thus, he became the first to chart a course of history that depended on the way the structure of thought changed over time. I guess, and this makes a lot of sense, that before then, the dominant view of history is that people in ancient times thought and had the exact same morals that people do now, that's something unchangeable. So like that led to some bizarre conclusions. You know, if you weren't open to the idea that, hey, maybe Romans and Greeks felt differently about things like that Persians do. And so and also that thought drifts over time. And I guess that does, like, why would you think as a 17th century Italian that first century Italians had radically different thoughts about things than you did?
Yeah.
You know, like there's
I feel like that's natural, right? Yeah. That's the natural viewpoint, is to just think everybody thinks like me.
There's a 1,000-year stretch of unbroken kind of like civilization. So that would, but nowadays it's like, that's one of the first things you think about.
Well, even just like they're human, they must have the same thought patterns as me. Yeah. I think is a natural thing, but that's not true.
Yeah.
It's not true.
And I think it's interesting that like, with the show as concerned with multiple people's points of view and different ways of thinking, this is the actual correct Giambattista, I thought that was a nice nod to the guy who first thought, well, what if people think different than us? Anyway, we next are treated to a scene of Philip reporting for active bridge duty. He's out of the doghouse into the main bridge, and Renfield. What is her name? I'm sorry. I'm going to try to get it right.
Rosenfeld.
Rosenfeld. Yeah. God, the bullshit has been locked in my brain at this point. No. Rosenfeld is nervous about the numbers that they're facing in the impending battle.
This seems like a just scene you got to do. I don't know, to get him back on the bridge. For him to witness his father's,
And it said they set
ego
it up
one more time. Yeah,
they set it up, and like I'm like, oh yeah, the ghost knife is going to come out at some point, and that didn't happen. I know we talked a couple of weeks ago about the phenomenon when you get to the end of a series that like there is very limited time for more gambits, more digressions, more diversions, more surprises, right? I do question why you bring up the idea of a last minute Laconian surprise if it's not going to happen in this episode.
Well, I think it's to crush Marco's hopes. You know, it's to bring him like to his lowest point and show that he's still pretending. Like all of the rugs have been pulled out from under him, right? Yeah. Like the only thing he's got left is those rail guns, and he doesn't necessarily think they're going to be enough. He's not even sure if he'll make it to the ring gate in time.
Yeah. That he needs some more reinforcements or something.
I think that's the only thing it does. And it was pretty effective in that. Okay. I felt like, and it's to crush the spirits of his crew. Well, his crew doesn't know. His crew doesn't know that. So I felt like there was a pall
that
over the entire Pella this episode.
It does, and I feel like you are onto something, but I don't. I felt like it's another instance, or not another. There have been tons of this, but there's one instance of this finale episode not doing all the connections to make it to where like if that had been established, and a crew is like, oh man, the railguns are awesome, and wait till we get something else, and like. Because it did feel like the crew of the Pella got their spirits crushed, and I'm not exactly sure why.
Yeah.
Maybe just another setback because they've had several, but like, I don't quite, I think I needed another scene or two or something to justify, because otherwise I kind of wish they just left it out.
Yeah.
We join the Rocinante as it's burning hard towards the gate ahead of Marco's fleet. It's right there hiding under the lee of the Gian Battista, and Clarissa receives some grim news about her health.
Oh, yeah.
Turns out
5 years to live.
The ancient Earth lady taking space meth didn't need to worry about her health. The young, healthy super soldier from Earth is the one we should have been worried about.
Yeah, she's got those back alley mods. This felt right. This felt like, oh, the shit she was doing to take Holden's life is going to shorten her own. That feels like poetic in a way, inappropriate. And I think it cheapens her life in a way that maybe like you don't want when she goes to sacrifice herself, or maybe it just heightens the tension of that, right? Because you're like, man, she could just say, fuck it, I have 5 years to live, I'm going to go into the reactor and I'm going to Spock myself. And not in the dirty way.
Go,
not in
go
the dirty
Spock
way.
Yourself. No. Yeah. Give herself
in the Star Trek 2 way. Uh-huh. I'm going to go into the reactor. I'm going to save my friends. I'm going to give my life for the person whose life I wanted to take at one point. Like, all of that, this 5 year thing makes it seem more possible that that's going to happen, to the point where when they didn't do it, I was very surprised.
Okay, so is Clarissa on the ship in the, she has to be, right? Because at the end of book five, she joins the crew.
I'm pretty sure, yeah. She's on there. I don't remember anything that she does in book six.
So, like, I was wondering if they established, because, like, to me, this was another thing where, like, I kind of see it, but I everything you said is true. It seems like it's a scene divided against itself.
Yeah.
She's going to die in 5 years, so it does make any sacrifice she would make necessarily cheaper, because it's different. Like, if you think, like, you know what, I've got a new lease on life, I'm out of prison, I'm with the people who are going to protect me and, you know, accept me, and I got a nice long life ahead of me, versus, oh, 5 years, that's different in terms of sacrificing. Like, a guy who walks in a nuclear reactor to save a town who just found out he had cancer and is going to have 6 months to live is different from a 24-year-old father of three doing it, you know? Uh-huh. And I felt like they were presenting all these options, and then they're going to do, and I'm like, well, if she Spocks herself, I guess that makes sense, but it's not as big a sacrifice, especially from, like, with all the different moral things they've done with her character. But, and then it kind of blew my mind when she didn't.
Yeah.
So it's like, what the hell is this? Because, like, if you take away this, her making the crew a meal is just a final icing on the cake, and Naomi accepting her and all the things total about her calling Amos the boss and all that kind of stuff. All that stuff works as just her. This is just her being fully becoming a part of the crew. Mm-hmm. I don't get the 5 year, like, unless that's a big plot point in the books, which doesn't seem like it from what I understand and where the books go from here. I thought it was another bizarre complication of the plot to introduce at the 11th hour. Not fatal, just weird. Just a weird choice.
And it doesn't even really shorten her life much in the context of the stories that the Expanse would tell, right? Because I'm thinking, like, in the Star Trek context, all of the first series of Star Trek takes place within a 5 year mission, right?
Yeah.
So, like, if you can get at least 3 seasons of a television show out of 5 years, I'm not super worried about Claire.
Yeah.
Going forward, I think we're gonna get enough of her if this thing picks up kind of where we are. So
true.
There's a lot of stuff I like about this, though, like Bobby being so happy she's going into battle. You can tell, right? Like, she's getting these rounds from AIM or from Holden. He's like, oh, man, can it really hold all that? She's like, fuck, yeah, it can.
And I thought the same, too. I'm like, on this armor, where does it all go? Is it, like, wrapping around her thighs and her biceps and, like, you know?
There's got to be a backpack on this.
There
thing.
Is a backpack, but it's not nearly enough to hold the crate of ammo that I think it's almost a joke. Like,
right.
You know, it's like when you, like in the prequels, I always wondered in the Star Wars prequels, when R2-D2 goes in those Naboo starfighters, where does his body go? Because the part where his head peaks out, like, You just superimpose an R2-D2 over there. His feet would be sticking out the tail. It's like not physically big enough to hold him, but, like, no one. So I'm like, when they wheel out the case, just as I was thinking, how the fuck does all they like lampshade it? I thought that was cute.
Yeah.
I also like the story about Alex, you know, his dispute about the Rocinante. It's like they didn't steal it. It's just the ship was smart enough to bust out and look for someone worthy enough to fly her.
Mm-hmm.
Although, I don't know. I always thought legitimate salvage was funny.
Uh-huh.
And like I wondered why they felt like the need to invent another thing that Alex would say that he never actually said on the show. But
I think it's because of Bobby's affinity for Alex. You know, like this is kind of just a... This is a Rossi crew thing at this point.
Oh, and I also thought that I like that they continue to pay tribute to Alex, the character, throughout this final episode.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff here with Naomi kind of talking about Claire, what she's doing. Amos making Claire the mechanic so he can go to go with the assault team in the drop pods. I really like this scene. Everybody is doing and saying nice things for the rest of the crew, right? Mm-hmm. Like there is something that feels like a crew here. Like they're all supporting each other. It's a pleasant moment before you go into battle. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to be harrowing. Yeah. It just feels good in a finale.
The other thing is, I freeze framed on the screen where it shows all of, what's gone wrong with Peaches here.
Oh, yeah.
And all the things it mentions, and one of the symptoms of this complex endocrine collapse syndrome is salt cravings.
Okay. It's not just that the food is bad.
It's not just the food is bad, and she's got to, like, this is one of the, like, tells that she's got.
Wow. I wonder if that's an after the fact joke. That
I don't
they wrote,
know.
And but, we're just like, let's explain the salt thing in this hilarious way. Or
and then they worked it in it because it's all in the background. Like it's like literally a half a second scene. If you don't freeze frame and look at the stuff, you'd miss it. And then there's also the payoff when she asks, "Is the food too salty?"
Mm-hmm.
I also really liked coming into the mess to eat and like her slapping Amos's hands away from trying to get it, and then him doing the same thing to Bobby.
Yeah.
Like it's not done. Like, I just thought that was just
what are you
really
gonna do? Get your hands in there. Get a spoon.
yeah.
Barbarian.
And then he just eats out of the pot anyway after everyone's done. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so good. I love these little moments with the crew.
I like it too. Avastrala is meditating when she receives word that they have located the Pella and are about to engage it with their main fleet. Meanwhile, Drummer prepares her ships for war, which kicks off the first of two major battle sequences in this episode. Unfortunately for all involved, Marco has at least one more ace up his sleeve. So I intend to discuss everything up until the Rocinante's part of the battle. So...
Okay.
Because it just starts. She goes into the ready room and launches torpedoes, and war begins.
Yeah. And like I said at the beginning, I really love the juxtaposition of all these scenes with everybody preparing in their own ways for the battle. It feels, again, like a climax, like a finale. Everybody is getting the last word in before things get really rough. And I was surprised, I guess, to see Avasarala up in the front, as surprised as her crew member.
It makes a lot of sense, though. Like, the real time...
When
like,
we're talking about the distances we're talking about, which, you know, to be effectively out of torpedo range, you have to be very far away.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, that might cause
like,
delays.
Like, even from Earth to Moon is a two-second round-trip delay.
Yeah.
You get out like Earth, so like if you stay out of like the hundreds of thousands of kilometer range that you would have to be safe, it would be a significant delay in the communications. And I thought that was interesting. Like that's something that like FDR and Churchill didn't have to contend with because you got the Earth covered.
Yeah.
Instantaneously. You might have fog of war where you're having a hard time reaching the commanders on the battlefield, but like talking to your supreme commander, that's not a problem. I thought, because I had the exact same issue, and then I'm like, well, that actually makes sense. Because some calls would want to go all the way to the top.
Yeah, I'm wondering what those calls could really be. Like, everybody knows the mission.
Yeah.
And I feel like there is probably a general in direct command of the fleet, because we don't ever see her issuing, like, orders like Drummer, right? Like,
she's not, like, charge of the Martians, for sure. Like, it's like a joint operation. Yeah.
Their generals would all be communicating and figuring that out. But, yeah, it made sense.
And it lets her, they have, like, you know, for the people who are slow to getting the message, it lets her have, like, a little mini debate about, like, why aren't the Belters doing more? We should just, when she's like, you know, well, Because he's like, I just wish we had more belters, especially with how much we stuck our neck out for him at series. And she's like, it's a great quote. It's too little, too late. The story of our species.
Yeah.
Which is by the time you really need someone, if you haven't already spent the time developing that relationship and at the nation state level, it's almost never happens. It's already too late to build that. So,
and are we kicking this fight off?
Yeah, it's kicking the fight off. I thought they did a good job of showing Marco being clever one last time. Cause it's not just the disguising of the freighter, but him knowing that the kind of piratical greed, I don't want to say like in a mat, but like the way a belter looks at like spoils of war is going to cause them to like not focus on the freighter. They're going to try to protect it at all costs, which he kind of like uses the rest of his fleet as a blade of armor to get away to get away clean. But it's clever. It's clever in a very Machiavellian utilitarian kind of way.
Yeah. And to the point where like when Officer Olive figures it out, The jig is already up, right? They've shed the facade, and now it's just the Pella.
It
shows that the Pella is not there. They got a 17% match on the engine's drive signature. Like,
right.
She figures it out a split second before the computers do.
And even the second time, there's this, like, you know, the freighter's breaking up, and Drummer's like, damn it, I told you no one to attack. It's not breaking up. It's actually ejecting its shit off of it.
Yeah, I like that.
And a little bit of season one nostalgia for the Rocinante's gas freighter gambit.
Yep, I was like, thinking, yeah, when I saw that, I'm like, oh, they're using the Rocinante trick where they just sort of like disguise themselves as something else. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. And, you know, it felt like a, because they've always said that the Pella is like, I think they upscaled it. Like, isn't this like, in the ship, it's a Doniger class, like the biggest and best. That Mars has, or it's a cruiser, it's a big battleship, so it single-handedly changes the tide of the battle. Like when it deploys and lets off its missiles, the other fleet's way out of position, they're not facing the right way to hit, because a lot of these smaller ships, if they have rail guns, they're not like swivel mount, you have to like turn, and it just rips through Drummer's fleet. The helmsman taking that PDC round and just his head pulping.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God.
It harkens back to season one, right? Like,
yes. Yeah.
Now at the dock. Like I said, it just kicks off. It's super intense. I think all the action here happening is like, you know, torpedoes are flying and PDCs are going off. And I'm sure there's probably a railgun or two in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's just chaos. And the battle is evolving so quickly that as Drummer reacts to it, I'm like, oh my God, I wouldn't be able to make the calls as fast as she does here. Holy shit.
No, Drummer's real good. And then there's also that, and I'm like, because again, I don't know how these books go, and I see Drummer's crippled, and she tells everybody to fall back, but like leave the Pella to me, and I'm like, oh my God, she's going to ram it. Mm-hmm. And then her crew realizes, oh my God, she's going to ram it. But the crew's resolute. They're going to do it.
Yeah.
And just as you think, I'm like, Jesus Christ, because I no doubt in my mind she's going to do it.
Uh-huh.
And just as I'm processing that, Walker comes on and is like, hey, boss bang, looks like we had the same idea. I'm just going to get there first. And fucking the old salty dog rams this guy. And
tries to, but one of Marco's ships sacrifices
himself because they're
sideline it. Yeah,
they're not. They're not cowards. That's not their problem.
No.
Enough shrapnel is able to catch up and clip the Pella and cripple it, which leads to another major loss for Marco's people, Rosenfeld.
It does so many purposes here. I really love the tactic here of having Walker come in and do this thing that Drummer was going to do, because by the time Walker tries it and fails mostly, fails ultimately, Drummer's out of position. Drummer's too late. She can't catch up to the Pella. Even the limping Pella. So she just has to tuck tail and limp back to her fleet. So it spares her at the same time that it lets her off the hook too. Because she would ram this thing, but then she'd be dead, right?
And I love that this is one of the scenes where I felt like everything worked exactly right and told a really easy to stay kinetic story. And then there's the bitter irony of her getting the all fleet blast. We've gotten intel that the Pella is going to be disguised as a freighter, and the look on Drummer, like, you know, it's the old, it says military intelligence is an oxymoron, you know?
Okay. Yeah.
And it's like the look on her face is like, you know, speaking of too little too late. And her looking out, and she got a new sunroof in her because like half the Tynan's just been peeled away.
Yeah.
And she's like, there's nothing left to do but to wish the Rossi luck because it's all going to be up to them now. Anything else we want to talk about this battle?
Not until we get to the Rossi's part.
Well, let's do that then. The Rocinante arrives at the ring gate with the freighter Giambattista in tow. As we see his grand, the Holden's grand plans, the wing in action. The freighter disgorged hundreds, if not thousands, of cargo container is into the ring, all rigged to dodge and evade the withering railgun fire from the ring station. Only a few dozen of these pods have infantry aboard, and a desperate and chaotic battle ensues.
And it's like a lot of things, right? It's drones, it's freight containers, some of them with people in them, some of them not. It's just a bunch of flak. It's just throwing shit out there for them to target, and they can't hit it all. So some of it's going to get through, right? There's a comment later like, oh, the rate is at 20%. That's pretty good odds. We get an 80% chance of getting through.
It's still, though, one out of five of you is going to die. Like, it reminds me of that scene.
Oh, I would
scene.
Be terrified if I was
in I can't remember if it was in the movie or if it was in the novelization of Saving Private Ryan, where one of the sergeants is like, you know, one of the troops guy, are we going to die, Sarge? He's like, hell no. One out of three at best, you know? Uh-huh. Like, look to your left, look to your right, and say a prayer for those son of a bitches, because one of them's going to make it, but you're going to make... Yeah, it's like him... And Bobby not knowing what a Russian roulette is, because... I don't know.
I guess.
Mars's culture is so distinct and, like, young and different from Earth that they don't have the same cultural... Or maybe just, like, that just shows what kind of circles that Amos and Bobby kind of ran around with.
Could be.
Did you get the reference of the good luck versus good hunting?
The reference? I no.
Apparently this is a Battlestar Galactica reference. That like Starbucks chews someone out for saying good luck before a big battle, and she says, you never say good luck, you say good hunting.
Huh.
And no, I guess this is an old naval tradition that like is starting in World War One during like submarine combat that they started saying that.
It gives the troops a little more agency, right? Like
yeah.
You don't need luck. You just need to hunt well.
Yeah. R. Crawford, one of our fans, pointed out last week, it came in after a feedback episode, but there's a possible Gattaca reference. Avasarala says, this is not the time to think about the swim back.
Okay. Sure.
And there's been like, we pointed a couple
just
of these out. There's
you've
been
got.
Like, oh, I wouldn't be surprised if every one of these episodes has a reference to a classic sci-fi series or movies that like Dan and Ty and the others are kind of like invested in, because it's nice. They paid homage to Martin, Gattaca, mm-hmm. Battlestar, like clearly the shoulders of giants that they're standing on.
Yeah.
I thought that also like there's a couple things like that. Naomi, as good as she is, that these Martian railguns are so good. They fire so fast that early on in the battle, they've already lost half their pods and she's having to crank the evasion patterns to maximum, which is just beating the hell out of the soldiers. This battle is primarily told through the eyes of Bobby and Amos. And Amos is a tough guy, but this is clearly a terrifying experience.
Yeah, that drop in, man. They stick with him the whole time. And it's very cool. I would say, I don't know how it's going to look in super high def, but in my copy of it, it looked a little dodgy in some spots, but for the most part, it looked awesome.
It just had a lot of motion blur. And I'm going to chalk that up to the bit rate. Because that makes a huge difference.
Could
but
be.
Like, and also it's an unnatural place to fight in. It's space, but it's inside the ring space. So everything has got this suffuse purple glow, and like the background is not natural. The background's busy anyway. It's this weird, you know, more pattern, like, you know, like it's kind of shifting and rippling. And
this felt to me like if you were to get in the Wright brothers original plane and fly through like a 4th of July celebration in one of the big cities,
or if you've ever
America.
Seen like Band of Brothers or that Operation Overlord, where it's like a paratrooper is going in on D-Day and like the sky is full of flak and tracer rounds, and you're just like praying that the gunner doesn't see your shoot, you know?
Uh-huh. No, it was awesome. 15 Gs during this. And this is the first time I think I've seen Amos like really struggle with keeping his shit together. You know, he's screaming. He's being pulled apart at every joint.
I mean, 15 G's will black you out within seconds. So, like, it's like when he's
stumped, that he doesn't black
like,
out.
Like, I was actually thinking, I wonder if he's briefly lost conscious because he hits the ground and he, like, just falls on his ass because, yeah.
In contrast to Bobby just kind of
Iron Manning in.
Yeah, I love it.
It's really cool.
It's great.
While this is all going on, the Rocinante gets clipped by one of the Martian railguns, and it turns out that protomolecule-derived armor is worth its weight in gold. It takes the hit, but one of the vital systems underneath, it's kind of like you're wearing a bulletproof vest and you still break a rib because the bullet pokes you.
Yeah.
There's a problem. Holden's losing power. That's a really bad... There's a couple of reasons it's bad. He's like... It looks like he's dancing on the surface of the void. And we know if something goes into the void of the ring gate, it just gets disincorporated.
Mm-hmm.
And he's having trouble, number one, maintaining his acceleration to keep ahead of the railgun's fire.
Yep.
And number two, maintaining that attitude to where he's not slipping into the danger zone. And I thought that was cool because...
Yeah.
It's a huge distance inside this thing. Mm-hmm. Like, if you remember in season three, like, I can't remember the speeds involved, but it's a pretty... So, like...
They talk about it taking months to traverse this thing at the speed the ring was allowing.
Yeah. So, like, these are pretty long-range railgun shots, you know? And that's all... And so, the Rossi's dodging about barely, you know? And it's everything that the Holden can do to keep it... and Peaches now has to what I thought sure she's going into. I'm like, this is why they built the reactor room.
Yeah,
she's gonna go in there, she's gonna put on silver gloves, she's gonna put her hands inside, she's gonna get blasted with the light, she's gonna have tumors all over her face, she's gonna transfer
shoot her into
her.
Space, the dogs will fix her,
she's
it'll
gonna
all
transfer
be fine.
Her consciousness to Amos and the dogs will bring her back to life and they tell the story
and she doesn't
of
even
her,
use her mods
she That's doesn't even use her mods they and which They tell. I thought they tell the story of her doing the Noble Doom sacrifice, and she just lives instead. Which
I think she was prepared
root for.
To.
I wanted that to happen, but why did you make me think? Why did you put the thumb on the scale of her dying so hard, Joe?
Yeah, it heightens the tension in those scenes. Certainly,
it does. It does.
And there's something nice about her not having to resort to the thing that she's promised her crew. She won't do again, right?
And it might be lethal, yeah.
Yeah, it would maybe help, it would maybe save her crew if she used them, but the fact that she doesn't have to use them and break her promise is even better.
Yeah.
So I like that moment.
They're also, at this point, the Medina station, as they get closer, starts shooting torps at the pods, so the Rocinante has to engage with PDCs, and now, like, if it was a mess, but, like, there's so much shrapnel, there's PDCs, there's torpedoes, things are exploding, and it's all happening around poor Amos.
Yeah.
The Rocinante makes it behind the Medina, so it's briefly shielded from its guns, and then...
What about the laser? Do they still have the laser? Could they have...
I think that's what they take out, the comms,
okay,
and the targeting array is what the Rock... And that's... I love it when the Rocinante slides and... Holden's like, our turn, motherfuckers, and he starts just railgunning the shit out of them.
And I love the piloting, like him peeking out, you know, to try and see if they could get a line on on something. And the
instantly the railgun fires back. Yeah.
And then just the grace with which that ship moves back and forth, even without Alex at the helm, it was cool.
It'd be better. Can't you imagine?
Right.
Like every time I see it, I just think of like how much better it'd be with Alex, doing his cowboy shit. Yeah. Oh well.
Yep.
The good news is we get a Martian behind the stick by the end of this episode. So now at this point the ground forces have managed to land near the reactor and fire control station, but they're pinned down by small arms and RPG fire, while the Rocinante is unable to provide air support because she's pinned down and turned by the railgun emplacements.
Yeah.
They're at an impasse, time is running out, people are dying all around Bobby and Amos.
Amos shouting, get to cover when the firing starts, and him just using Bobby as a shield.
Yeah, just gets behind. Yeah, man. Run the quarterback sneak option. Get behind the center and just push forward.
Yep.
And
then, you know, they get stuck in this little, alcove there. And people are still getting picked off. And then Bobby goes in one-man army, and I'm just like, yes. There's so many... Damn, that's cool moments here.
It is cool. I felt like her jetting. I have a hard time with because this is what everyone does. They slow down time to give everyone their hero moment, but it always bothers me because why is she doing the dramatic pose before she does this? Why is she doing that? And then so she goes down. She does just like she does in season 2, episode 1. She launches her shoulder missiles. They all go and detonate on the thing. But then she starts taking the armor-piercing rounds. She ragdolls. Things look grim. She's the airborne guys are above her, and they're launching RPGs. And then here comes Amos.
Yeah.
And he takes out a few. And this is the part where, again, they're telling me the story of Bobby and Amos doing everything they can and going to check out. And the Ross, and then I don't understand why. What is the point of having Amos take all those shots and be like, screw? It feels like he's getting just riddled with bullets, like Swiss cheese. And it's a heroic sacrifice. And then the Rocinante comes like an avenging angel, which is badass. But I'm like, too little, too late. And then Amos just gets up and says, "Fuck yeah, Rossi." I'm like, okay.
I did have questions about gravity. I can't remember what the Medina station's gravity situation is. I know they're spinning the drum, but on the actual ring center, the nucleus, whatever.
There was gravity inside, but when she gets ragdolled, she just does the thing where she's floating with one foot attached with a mag boot. So I think it's zero G.
And I think in that case, it's better if Amos goes in, saves her from the RPG, and then pulls her to the side to get cover.
Agreed. I don't know what he thinks he's doing by covering her Goliath suit of armor with his Martian Kevlar. I thought it was a friend trying to save his other friend in vain. It felt like, again, a noble sacrifice.
And you could still have the Rossi come in and save them both, right? If the Martian Belter forces are advancing on them, right? And it's clear that Bobby's out cold. She's not going to be able to save Amos when 16 dudes come around the corner, when these drop troops land. You still could have done it, and Rossi could have saved the day in the same way, but I feel you. But it was still super exciting.
Yeah, and up until that, I have zero criticisms for anything except for that very last bit. And I know they're trying. Mm-hmm. I know they're trying to wring the maximum amount of emotional excitement. I just don't like being jerked around. It's just this is shades and not nearly as egregious, but I think it's the third episode in Game of Thrones, the first big battle for Winterfell.
Yeah.
When multiple main characters go underneath a dozen people all stabbing into them, and you're like, "Oh, that person just died." And then 5 minutes later, they're not dead. You know,
is that the Battle of the Bastards?
Nah, I forget what it might be called. Battle of Winterfell. I don't know. But it's I don't know, man. I just, as an audience member, I'm just too smart for that shit. And it just makes me irritated. But I get, again, if you're going to do it on the finale episode when, because if this show was to continue to go on, every time someone was in mortal danger, I'd be like, well, they're just going to,
those things compound. Yeah,
exactly. Sure. After the battle. So now, the guns are destroyed. Bobby apologizes for this, but I don't know, because if she doesn't do that, I think the tactical situation is infinitely worse.
Far worse, yeah. She calls an audible that doesn't achieve their ultimate goal, but does keep them in the game.
It does, yeah. It keeps they're hanging on there by fingernails. After this battle, Duarte communicates with Marco and tells him on no uncertain terms his requests for reinforcements are denied.
Yeah.
And Philip demands to know how Marco keeps shrugging off all the death and destruction that's being done in his name.
This is such a crushing blow to Marco, and I'm just sitting there. I'm the one cackling here at this point because I want Marco to lose. And when Duarte signs off, "Oh, dang," I'm like, "Aw, dang, Veltaloda." You just got screwed.
Yeah, which if you don't know, that's means farewell.
Right.
Au revoir.
Yeah. And it's meant as a backhanded sign-off here, right? This is the last fucking time we're going to talk because you're screwed.
Yeah. And his his expression of just pure impotent rage, and as soon as Philip comes in, he you can see him with a little bit of effort transform that into just supreme confidence, which I don't think we've ever seen him do that. We've seen him go from pissy rage to petulance and things like that, but this, they talk about this in the book all the time, where no matter what happens to Marco, it's always the best thing that's ever happened.
Yeah,
and he always spends it. And you see this gift, because for whatever reason, and we already talked about how I don't think either one of us thought they told the story of the Pella just being, because like in my mind, the Pella is this close to achieving its goal. Like, it's too bad the railguns went down, but they're going to get there with the lead time. If they get the railguns going, then they've probably still won. And the crew's moping around like they lost a battle instead of winning it. And I didn't think they told that story.
I agree. The crew doesn't seem clued in enough to understand the situation they're in. But this is the first time, and this is a super effective thing they're doing with Marco. This is the first time I felt like Marco's bravado and spin was forced.
Yeah.
Like, even he knows he's fucked here. And this isn't just a setback. This is the end. And when he comes in there saying, this is the end of the Innas, I'm like, dude, you could have stopped at the beginning and it would have been more honest, because you know that this is the end. Like, without Duarte's support, without having actually destroyed the Martian and Earther fleets, and not having your railguns, I think you're still fucked. I think you get to the ring gate and you have a better chance of holding them off, but I think you're still done.
Yeah. Yeah.
The odds are at least even at this point. And I don't think that goes well for you. You're not as experienced at this.
Oh, no. Yeah. You don't know how to fight with the machine. Like, although they have gotten into quite a few scrapes, they've probably gotten some experience. But I agree. And I also thought it was a subtle, nice show of how, like, a narcissist can, like, when they get at the end of the ropes, like, change course. Because before, we've always seen the crew chant, you know, Marco or Philip, or, you know, here he's like, but this is, he's finally at the end of his rope focusing on, this is a team effort. Mm-hmm. This is what we're all doing. It's no longer for my, and he starts the belt the Loda chant, which I thought was a nice way for the show to pay homage to our podcast, you know. To chant our name and thanks for all of the promotion we've done, and honestly, we're instrumental in the show's success.
I think we've done a great job
as it's being canceled before its third trilogy. The Belt of Loda takes full credit for the success and failure of the Expanse. But yeah, no, I thought that was a classic, like, narcissist pivot. Yeah. And Philip looks like he's about to throw up.
Uh-huh.
Like, once again, he sees his dad start his, and like in a way like no one else in the crew can see it the way he can.
Uh-huh. And especially now, like, you know, he's seen it so many times before. He just wasn't willing to recognize it for what it is.
Yeah, he saw it with Carol, it's his dad, right? He saw it with Sin. And he really thought that Rosenfeld.
Yeah.
I really thought that he thought that maybe that would get a reaction. Yeah. Like, that this person is most loyal, who's also kind of been a surrogate mother figure for him, you know, like to shield him from the worst of his father's impulses and kind of build him up and all that. Father, no reaction.
Yeah.
And he finally sees that, like we talked about, like, you know, Marco thinks the true belters are just him and Philip, and if push comes to shove, just him. And this is Philip realizing the truth of that statement.
Yeah, I think there's more on Philip's realization and stuff in the book, and almost to the point where, like, I question why they had him go back to his post after he has the private moment with his father, where his father's like, after all we've been through, you still don't see it. Mm-hmm. He's like, no, I do now. That to me is the moment he walks out the door, not when he goes back and sits down and Rosenfeld gets killed and all that. It's more like when he sees his father for who he truly is. That's the turning point. Not. Yeah. And I guess if you want to say, well, the way he treats his second and, you know, the surrogate mother is that turning point. But I felt it came a little earlier.
Yeah. Before we get to the end of the episode, because there's still quite a bit left, let's take a quick break. All right, we're back. As Holden and the crew of the Rocinante get some bad news from Officer Rala, they have no ships. The main Joint Strike Command has no ships left that can reinforce them in time before Marco arrives at the gate, leaving them to figure out how they can take on Marco's entire fleet, the remnants of it, with just one ship, with very little fuel and very little ammunition.
Mm-hmm. I guess Bobby was a little weird in this scene. She's been so gung-ho to bring this fight, and I guess she's brought the fight. she's gotten some of the taste of that. Maybe she's a little calmer now, but you know, she's suggesting all these like alternatives that get them out of there, right? To cut and run, as Amos says. Do any of us really want to do that? And Holden kind of suggests to Bobby, hey, if you don't want to continue on with this, you can go. And Bobby doesn't immediately say, are you fucking kidding me?
I think
this is a fight I've been spoiling for three seasons now.
Yeah. I think the idea there is that Rocinante has all the survivors of the ground campaign because the freighter's like, you know, not going to make it out of here. And I don't think Bobby thought he was talking to her, even though she's included. He's talking about like,
but he directly walks up to her and says, like, if you want to go, you can go.
Well, no, he says like anyone that on this ship that wants out, I understand. But I don't think Bobby thought he was. I thought he was like this really? Very clearly. Okay. I mean,
I thought
weird.
He was looking Bobby in the eye.
No,
when he
did because okay. He was saying because wasn't she the commander of the ground forces? So maybe she would be the one that would tell them that. But I don't think they did a good job of showing like how many people survived.
Okay, like they don't need to be here, is what you're saying?
Yeah, like, or like they didn't sign up for this. They didn't sign like it's like this is truly a suicide mission, is what it's looking like to shape up to be.
Yeah, you could still escape.
But they there's like, hey, could we use the Rocinante to power the guns? There's no freaking way. It would take us weeks to even do it. You know, there's also, you know, live to fight another day. We get through one of the gates and make off. We could steal the fuel from Medina. And then they, you know, like I said, Amos calls them out. It's like no one here is wanting to cut and run. So then they got a new plan, which is using the GM Batista to soften up Marco's fleet by exploding it and then using their few missiles and rail guns. That they know they're not going to win. Mm-hmm. This is them trying to cripple Marco to where the other good guys can get there eventually and press the advantage.
Yeah, because all three battle groups are still burning for the ring. Yep. They're just not going to make it in time to stop Marco.
And at this point, Naomi suggests using the ring entities. And it's another problem I thought where like this felt compressed because, or maybe they're making another kind of doors and corners point. But like, it seems insane to me that, sure, Marco taking over the solar system is bad. Do you know what's worse? Open up the ring gate entities and exterminating all life in the solar system.
And I don't think Holden voices that strongly enough.
Because he's the one that saw in the vision what can happen.
He's
and
the only
stakes.
Guy that I have that objection to. I think everybody else is like, hell yes, let's do this.
Yeah,
save our own lives.
It's the devil we don't
war.
Know versus like, the one we do. But like,
yeah, but Holden.
It felt like during World War II, it's like, well, Hitler might take over the Earth, so let's open up a gate to hell.
Right.
But I'm like, wait a second. Hitler taking over Earth is bad? But you could eventually beat him. If you open up a ring gate to hell and the whole world's destroyed, then what the fuck?
Let's open the gate to hell and just hope the devil doesn't walk through, right?
Exactly.
Is what they're doing
yeah,
here.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
that's
yeah. We want to
risky.
Use hellfire to destroy our enemies. Hopefully no demons come through.
Yeah.
And again, I feel like if they had a little bit more time, they could have had a little bit more discussion or Holden could give his misgivings or... You know, like have a discussion about like the real stakes because he's like, you know, I saw what happens when these people wake up and it could mean the destruction versus like, but if.
Is it just that Ava Sarala has already had this conversation with him?
But to me,
she set up the stakes in his mind.
It doesn't feel like the show remembers what the stakes are because they're like, well, what happens to the ring gates? And they're like, it's
like they wouldn't need to ask that question again, right?
Maybe, but like, it feels very cavalier to. Be like, you know what, ring gate aliens, that's the call. When you know, one of these guys had a vivid vision of the entire solar system being exploded as a result of this course of action.
I guess, yeah, maybe give Holden a moment here to not even voice these arguments again, because he has with Ava Sarala, and she's already told him that the stakes are higher and the more immediate stakes are more important. Just give him a moment to where the crew looks to him. And says, is this what we're really going to do?
Yeah.
And the camera just hangs on him. And you can feel the weight of him debating it in his own mind, right?
Well, and I don't know if the stakes are clear. Because you're clear to me because I just watched the whole season. But, like, it's been since early going season 4, late season 3, since Holden has articulated. Like, yeah, he's talking about the aliens are waking up and they're getting angry. But, like, it's been 3 seasons since we've seen that lead to anything but a singular ship being eaten. Like, the whole idea that, like, no, what happens when this happens is eventually the solar system gets exterminated or, you know,
I think you can let your audience just remember that.
So long, and then it's been a couple seasons. I don't know.
It has, but I mean, we saw Savitaire get eaten. Mm-hmm. The last season, we've already had this discussion with Ava Sarala. I think there would have been enough there.
Okay,
but they didn't give it that beat, right? I feel like right. it did need a beat more, but it also doesn't need to rehash the argument.
And here's the other thing is like. This feels like a great way to end it, but like visually it feels a little anticlimactic because they just launched a freighter, they launched the missiles, the music swells, but what actually happens is red CGI fire eats the fleet, and it's almost like the Jurassic Park ending where, you know, Grant and
the T-Rex,
he's got the kids and they've almost saved the day, but here's the Vlad and they're going to die. And then the T-Rex comes through and eats them. And I'm like, then that felt awesome in Jurassic Park because that was kind of, but like, this is like, I don't know. I guess it's a clever, the idea is how the crew won, not the execution of it.
And they give you a little more time to process that in the book.
Yeah,
because you're reading it, so it takes longer. But B, I think they dwell on it a little bit more.
And I am glad because
give it a whole window, like a timing window. Like we have 10 minutes to, we have a window of 10 minutes once we trigger it for Marco to come through. If he wisens up and understands what we're doing, he's just gonna stop.
And I do love
divert himself. Like
my first time through, my worst fear was he was going to slide through like Salvatore and like be smug and lecturing people on how superior he is until he just winks out of existence. But to the show's credit, he realizes at the very last minute what's happening. I don't know if he knows what's happening, but he knows something bad is happening. And he screams, "Veer off," just as the red fire starts taking him. Yeah. And I thought that was...
And they have him look right into the camera. You get to see that smug face one more time as it disincorporates. It is a moment there. But I get you. It's also like... weirdly abbreviated.
But I will say that like what kind of makes up for it is Naomi's reaction because in her mind, she's just watched her son being eaten by demon fire.
And in our mind.
And our mind too at that moment, point. Yeah. Cause I thought it's funny. Cause like I heard your mildly interesting words echoing. Like I'm not happy with where Philip and I'm like, well, I can see. Cause like I was hoping that Philip would maybe betray his father at the last moment. It'd probably be doomed and whatnot. But like him dying in the ring gate, I'm like, well, maybe I see that's disappointing, but no more disappointing than his father's fate. And then turns out he did a little tricky.
He just walks off, which we'll talk about in a sec.
Yeah. So the Rossi's crew watches with satisfaction and relief. I thought, all that stuff. And Naomi screaming.
Even though I believe Holden her.
Trying to comfort her.
Like, she's already made up her mind, right? Like she doesn't hesitate on this. She comes up with the plan that she knows is going to kill her son. There's no hesitation here, but there's still an emotion to it.
Also,
that felt right.
Now that I'm going back and reintegrating everything I felt about the season, it does make Holden's decision to spare Marco indefensible. I guess it did save Philip. And I don't know what role Philip has going forward.
Sort of accidentally.
But like, oh my God, so many less people would have died if he'd have just... Because like so many people die in these battles and raids at the end that just wouldn't have happened if he had killed Marco. So that's a bummer.
Yeah, there's a cost, but I guess it's not as personal.
I almost wonder how many, if Duarte would have delivered those last few railguns too, if Marco had died.
Yeah, maybe not.
Yeah, because it seems like, you know, they were really only useful for a distraction so that Earth does. We forgot all about those Laconians, you know? So we fade to black. And I think we might have predicted this in preseason. It's a little bit Lord of the Ringy or a little bit Return of the Kingy, I should say, because you've got multiple what feels like final endings that kind of bleed into each other. So at some point in the future, after all this is over, all the major players from Earth, Mars, and the OPA are around a large conference table on Ceres Station discussing a way to share the ring safely for all.
I love this scene.
Mm-hmm.
I love everything that happens with this negotiation and the finality of it up to the end of this episode. It's brilliant. And only half of this stuff happens in the book. So. Yeah.
And everyone's point from their own individual point of view makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Like, how can we trust you with our lives when half of you are only too willing to exterminate you? How can we trust you with your word when you've broken it for over 100 years? Like,
I'm looking at the evolution of Holden into like a Fred Johnson type character. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at if Fred Johnson were in Drummer's seat, things go a lot different and the mm-hmm. Belters probably don't get what they want. Like, he's not the uncompromising Belter that they need.
And even if they did, would the Belters believe it? Because part of it is like,
sure.
Oh, what is the best deal Fred Johnson, Earth's lapdog, got for us?
Uh-huh.
You know?
It is perfect. Just absolutely perfect that the only person in the room that everyone can agree to do this is Holden.
And it makes sense. It makes sense.
He's on nobody's side. He's on the side of people. It's kind of touching.
And I also, it's kind of funny because as Avasaral is ticking off all the like impossible requirements for who could possibly be trusted to lead this effort, and like slowly everyone in the conference room starts looking, and Holden, of course, is the last person to realize the sandbag is about to fall and hit him right in the head. And I also like, I just love the scene, the drummer where like Avasaral is very paternalistically saying like, look, I give you my word that you'll be treated with dignity and respect. And drummer's like, I give you my word you'll be treated with dignity and respect. I give you my word that mm-hmm. we will carve out our niche and let you kill us. It's like, why? Oh, is that how good does that make you feel? Why is your word good enough for me, but my word's not good enough for you? And it's an unanswerable question because
there's no argument you can mount there that's not hypocritical.
No, especially with the totality of the history of the two sides. Because if it'd be one thing if Earth had never broken their word to the Belt, but we know that's not true.
Yep.
So I thought that was great, and you know, Holden like being the one to kind of like suggesting the thing that ends up happening, but it's his kind of like worst nightmare. And again, we have another kind of fade to black, skip ahead at some point in the future. A very dapper, it must be said, Holden.
Oh, yeah. He's in a tux, a space tux.
And he's in a space tux. You can tell it's a space tux because it's like missing collars.
Yeah. No tie. Just a weird.
Yeah. Strange, ties don't work in zero G. No buttons. They're just like always flapping up in your face. You can't have space ties. You know, actually,
a space tie would have been too earther, right? Like, That would have said, hey, we're earthers, because Belter's been like, fuck this guy in his tie. That's not even a piece of material that works in our culture. Yeah.
Someone pointed out what I feel is something obvious, and I think it was this in the Discord, because you've been mentioning how like Avis Ra's wardrobe has really changed in the last few weeks, and we talked about it being like a darker, more militaristic look. But someone also pointed out, it's like, well, we're used to seeing her in flowing robes and elaborate hairstyles, and now she's wearing the form-fitting jumpsuits and the updos of zero gravity.
She's still got her trench coat cape thing, which might get in the way every once in a while.
Closer. Like, and when she's going into battle, she's wearing a jumpsuit in this episode.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, he is holding a press conference as the new president of the very newly formed trade union. And his first official act is controversial, Jim.
Yeah, as he's building up to this, before he's announced, like, my second action, I think, is as president is to resign. Mm-hmm. Before that, I'm thinking, okay, this is a good gateway to the future. Holden is the man to take on this mantle. But you have to think beyond Holden. How does the stability come permanently? Because Holden can be assassinated, and I'm sure there are many factions that would love to assassinate him, much like they wanted to assassinate Fred Johnson and succeeded in that. So, like, if Holden falls, what happens to the transport union? And it was a great move to put Drummer in as VP, because if he falls, they also have to take her out, or it just defaults to the Belters. I did not see him pulling that ripcord immediately, because that doesn't happen in the books, and it was so awesome.
So satisfying.
The build up when Avasarala can feel it coming.
And she's trying, because like, he's at the end of his speech.
Motherfucker.
You see him at the end of his speech, and Avasarala starts to go up to the podium to do her shtick, and he just like continues on, and you can like, she's like, oh shit.
Yep. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. I do still have questions about like, how does this become a lasting institution that is run by Belters, or at least run by the independent?
Yeah, how do they maintain their belt? I mean, and there's like...
Those are answers for the future, right? Those are not answers for now. Answers for now are, we have a belter at the head of this. She's uncompromising. She will get the belters with
the
lead.
And the other nations are already bound by law to respect it. So, like, you know, he's caused a constitutional crisis, but you might as well, like, you know, I mean... Yeah, if you want to,
if you want to go back on your word this hard again,
just because you know, someone who saved y'all's lives has taken the control, like, then how much do you really trust? Like, how much of this is just bullshit?
Yeah, and he's bought time for them to potentially create, you know, a situation inside the ring that is not surmountable by enemy forces.
Yeah.
So he might have bought the Belters enough time to get back on their feet.
It's funny because some of this stuff is stuff we struggle with right now, because, like, there is a worry among some of the more conservative elements in society about the impending transformation America, where white people will no longer be a super majority. Probably will be a plurality, but not a majority.
Yeah,
and it's hard to try to get in their headspace without realizing that they're just extremely afraid that if minorities have the real levers of power, that they're going to do to us what we have done to them.
Yeah, there's a reckoning.
There's this, oh my God, we can't, like, there's a multi-pronged attack. We can't let that happen. We got to close our borders. We got to increase our birth rates. We got to stop teaching history. So people, like, and this is such a great example of, like, if that's what you're afraid of, then, brothers and sisters, we better set some laws that bind all of us and protect all of us as individuals and as distinct groups, and force it equally, because that's the only, like, fuck, man. Like,
yeah.
Does it make you feel good for minorities to be like, well, we're not going to enslave and take advantage and oppress you when we get to be the majority? Because if they did, the real uncomfortable realization is it would be just desserts.
Right.
As a white man, I don't want that to happen. But, like, at some point, we're going to have to trust each other and treat each other fairly, or it'll just continually be a cycle of oppression, overthrow of oppression, revenge, which leads...
I'm looking for our Holden. I'm looking for the guy that everyone can look to, Holden's, the girl drummers. That everyone can look to, whoever. Yeah, you need that one good person, right? I mean, that's what Prax says. That's what Absarala says. It's got
to
be.
You need a side strong enough to take a blow, and then you need someone on the other side wise enough to realize what a sacrifice it was, and that there's something that we can build on.
And I love...
Without both of those sides, it won't happen.
I could see this coming off as cheesy. I could see this coming off as, like, people, you know, have... You've let the better, what is shit? What is the term? The better,
better angels.
But yes, you've leaned so heavily on better angels and said that these characters who were these warmongers before and these torturers have become those better angels. Yeah. That it could seem almost silly.
Yeah,
but they don't go there, right? They let the better angel be the better angel in Holden. Like, Avasarala doesn't come all the way around. Mm-mm. Avasarala is like, I want to help the belt, but only insofar as it also helps me.
And as long as,
like, I don't want to give up everything to the belt.
And as long as ultimately we're in charge. So if something goes off the right, like, I
still feel like the parent in the room, and I've got to keep these kids in line. Yeah. But,
and her first instinct is to undo it all. Like, oh, this is bullshit. Right? You duplicitous little shit. I'm going to undo it all.
And I love that they don't get her all the way to the better angel in this. It wouldn't feel right.
But she is willing to trust Holden.
She was just enough on board with the idea of a peaceful future that it got them to where the better angel could step in.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, sometimes, like, there's been the theme this whole season. Like, you don't have to have all of society singing Kumbaya. You need a few good people to step forward at a crucial moment and put their own... their own fears and desires aside and act of, like, what's truly in the best interest for the greater amount of people, to do something that's selfless, to do something brave. And it doesn't take them you need those people to create these opportunities where you have these openings for trust and understanding and peace. And again, like, this is just, to the extent that I have some quibbles over this final episode, I actually really, really like the final season. And I think this is, like, this is just a stunning statement on, like, political geopolitics.
Right.
Like, this is, like, so instructive on so many different, like, conflicts and stuff that you can analyze through right now. And it's such a great parable for our times. And I think they really, really nailed the, because I, you know, I remember saying, like, what is this show's thesis going to be? Yeah. What is the way out of this? And I think this is exactly right. It is the people in power have to be willing to get a little bit of comeuppance. The people who got the comeuppance have to kind of get their fill and kind of get sick up, you know, like, oh God, what have we done? And then you have to find another way. You got to stop killing your way to a better tomorrow.
Yeah. And Naomi says, you know, essentially that in the end of this. I know we haven't got to the end, but I want to like put a final stamp on this season and say that's why I love this episode. Yes, around the margins, there are some things about like, oh, maybe the action didn't have to go this way or whatever. But it was so exciting. And when it comes down on its main thesis, that's what we've always loved about The Expanse, right? Yes, it's been set in space and we love that stuff. It's cool. The characters are awesome. They're a ton of fun at times. But like the broader thing that they were doing, the socio-political stuff that they're talking about here with these different factions and where are they going to end up on that? I think it ended up in the perfect place.
I agree.
Because it's not naive.
No.
It's not.
It's fully informed.
It is fully informed, yes, by history, by our current society, by everything that we know as human beings. Well, I don't want to give them too much credit, right? I don't think they're like full-on historians here. Yeah. But like
Dan and Ty for president 2024. I don't know about right. that, but
they'd probably, you know, blush when I'm talking all this. But like as far as television goes, I've not seen it done better. And that's what I loved about these.
Yeah.
These closing moments.
Like I said, I've definitely seen elements and flashes of like these kind of empathy things in Star Trek, but it's never been fully informed by people integrating like what the you know, by really what it's like to live under the boot, you know, by what it's like to feel like you are powerless to improve your situation.
Yeah.
I just think it's great. And it's such a great book into with these last two episodes. Like last episode, you had Officer Olive with the, oh, James, you're so impossible. And now she says at the end, much less exasperated, but in the same kind of like, oh, James, I hope you're right.
Yeah.
And that's all you can do. Like it's a bet that if we try something different and it's maybe not immediately better the next year, the next decade, but 100 years from now, what will things look differently because these people opened a little bit of doors to trust and empathy and walk through them.
And that character in Holden who felt so naive at the beginning, right? Like giving all this information out to everyone feels like a stupid thing to do.
Yeah.
And so many characters are saying it. It's naive. And I think he hadn't even considered any of the consequences, right? He only comes to that stuff through Fred Johnson and his interactions there.
Oh, that's the thing none of these people came out of the show, came into the show ready to do any of these things. It was all the like the experiences they had. Like Drummer wouldn't be Drummer without her experience with Fred, without her experience with Dawes, without her experience with Kloss. Holden wouldn't be Holden without his experience with Amos and Naomi and Miller and Prax and Avasarala, and it's
that character all works, makes it feel real.
They all needed the lived experiences to be able to appreciate. And some people, like I said, you need these people who can build bridges too. Like I love that line of Holden. It's like, you know, I'm gonna put this trust in a people that I respect and occasionally love. You know, like. You have to have those people who are respected. Like they've had the experiences to where people respect them. And that's the problem, I guess, in today is like, if anything, we're being more and more isolated, you know, like, there's less and less opportunities for people to kind of mix and see how other people do. And you'd think the internet makes it easier, but it doesn't seem like to be doing it. It seems like the tools we put on top of the internet are dividing us more than they're showing us what we have in common. And that's a shame because that's not how I thought things would go 15 years ago.
You have a tool that's being improperly used. Yeah, it does feel like a shame.
Oh my God, social media is a protomolecule.
Kinda.
It can do great things, but it also can fucking disassemble you down to an atomic level.
Yeah.
And shovel you into
specter that's just going to hang over us for all until of eternity.
Until we master it.
Yeah, and who's going to be... Do we want a Duarte trying to master that? He doesn't seem like the greatest guy. I don't know. I really love it. And, you know, ultimately, that's what I wanted to be satisfied. It's not you know, particular moments that pull off perfectly a piece of action. It's it's what is this show trying to say? How is it going to get there? Is it going to feel right? And it does.
Yeah. And that brings us to the end. The end of all things, at least for now.
I have to take back everything I just said. Okay, yep, tell us about the scene.
We are treated to an extended denouement, offering us the final chance to say goodbye to this ship and this crew who have meant so much to us these past few years.
Okay, yeah, this part is great. I love this moment. I love seeing the Rossi fly off into the black. I changed and updated and new and something else, you know, made better by all of its parts, both internally with the crew and externally with the protomolecule hull plating. There's something poetic about
the end of
this.
Yeah, I thought they got a new color scheme. I'm like, that's odd. But then I realized, oh no, that's the weird protomolecule armor strapped all over it. Yeah.
And it's got like a look that synthesizes every look of the series too. Okay. I don't want to get too political here. There's a definite red, white, and blue motif going on here. I think they're saying something meta about us as a country right now. But also, they're incorporating all the looks, because Protomolecule is very blue. The entities inside the whatever void ring gate thing are very red, right? And so now you've synthesized all the looks thematically of the show into the Rocinante. The UNN, very blue. The Martians, very red. We've taken all the pieces that make everything up in the aesthetic of this show and put them onto one ship. It's great.
I love the establishment that Bobby's their new pilot, permanent member of the crew. There's a little bit of good-natured, you know, them being nervous and, oh, I wonder what this button does. And and then Amos cracking that, like, it can't be worse, a rougher ride than when Holden is on the stick. I thought it was a great moment, Peaches remaking the devil face pin.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
then like, the reveal of when she flips her and she's got one, too. Like, again, you're dead in 4.5 years, but okay.
But you got all the Star Trek's 5-year continuing mission ahead of you. Yeah, it's true.
And who knows what the protomod is? She could just, the dogs will fix her. Yeah, she'll be back. Don't worry.
A little bluer, but no worse
for
wear.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. A little losing her fragile grip on humanity.
Jitterier.
And I just, Amos's look of content and happiness at this situation.
Yeah.
And then ending with Naomi and Holden in their bed, curled up in their bunk. And I you know, this is a bunch of speechifying that the showrunners are doing on behalf of the characters, but I like it. Like, the universe doesn't give a shit. It's never going to tell us what we did is right or wrong. But one thing we can be sure of is if we help people and it works, someone's life gets better and we feel good about it. And like, that seems like a win under various moral systems to me.
And the thing about, like, you didn't do this for a reward. You didn't do this for a status. You didn't do it for any reason other than it was the right thing to do. And boy, that's tough, you know, in our dog eat dog world, to do anything without expectation of gain is like, yeah, it's tough.
Those dog eat dog worlds. I also
eat.
This is also where we find out the Philip exited stage left, right at the last moment. He gets out and changes his name to Philip Nagata. I don't know what that means, because I feel like in the future there'd be so much biometric bullshit that, like, you would need Eric. Yeah, you gotta go seek Eric out in New Baltimore.
Yeah,
and get your fucking ID changed, because good luck, good luck, kid. But
Baltimoon.
Yeah, and there's something right about, like, literally, as Naomi's talking about how you never know the ripple effects of these things. And I criticize Holden for not killing Marco, but, like, the ripple effect here, Naomi doesn't know it. Jim doesn't know, but he saves this kid's life. And, you know, someone, took exception with me describing Philip as an innocent in the feedback episode, but, like, I think if you're a 16 to 18 year old kid and you grew up in what is essentially a terrorist cult, you are as innocent as I think I can, you know, because, like, you just didn't have a chance.
Right? And I think a lot of people, if you're in the camp that thinks, you know, Philip made his choices, you're going to be like, what the fuck, in this scene where he goes to Marco and says, what choice did I have?
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. I was a kid. I was born into this.
Yeah. I was the thing you made me.
Yeah.
In a very real way.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I get it, but I can understand, I guess, why people wouldn't.
Yeah. And then I really liked the moment where, like, Holden is essentially pitching the next series, which is like, you know, probably piracy will be an issue. We could provide security, or maybe we can do some consulting at the colonies, or, you know, still need to track down what happened to that protomod. And Naomi's like, you know what? Can we just enjoy this moment? And then Rocinante flies off into the Milky Way, and it's beautiful. It's, yeah, it's one of those, like, the end of the Star Trek era where Kirk says, you know, set the course to the second star by morning, or whatever the Peter Pan quote is. And sure. You just, it's the voyage isn't over. They're still out in the stars, and we may or may not hear the rest of the story, but we got a pretty satisfying end to the story that was being told thus far.
Yeah, I think it's even stronger than the book.
Wow.
The way the book ends. It felt anticlimactic for Philip just to kind of walk off. Because all of that, they've reordered it here. They ordered the battle happening first and all this killing and stuff. And this is almost like a denouement or whatever. Mm. In the book, it's the opposite. Philip just walks off and then everything else happens. And you're like, wait, Philip, what? I want to know more about what Philip's going to do. Like, yeah, he's not going to be here. He's broken the hold of his father. But, like, I felt like I wanted more from the book version of the Philip story. This felt different. This felt like if I have any complaints, it's only residual book complaints.
And Philip being survived felt like the kind of a lot of these things felt like attempted to be kind of what I would say nice surprises. You know, like, you didn't expect Clarissa to be on death's door, but she's going to live. You didn't expect Amos and Bobby to survive the situation. This did feel like a nice surprise. I'd seen Naomi process the grief. It felt real. I felt appropriately devastated for her. I got kind of emotional at this because, like, I love it when good people work together to make a better tomorrow. And then it really worked for me to see Philip, like, it goes back to what Naomi said last season. Like, the only thing you have control over in situations like this is walking away.
Yeah.
You can't stop it. You can't change your father. You can't save him. But you can decide that I'm not going to be a part of this anymore. And that little nugget of wisdom that she gave him saved his life. And it just works so well thematically with her monologue, and I thought it was emotionally effective.
Let me ask you this: do you think him changing his name to Nagata is supposed to indicate that he's going to seek her out, like she said to do? Like, when you before you kill yourself, come find me.
Yeah, I think I wasn't sure. I mean, is that definitely
the implication for the future?
It was definitely him turning over a new leaf. Like, I'm repudiating my father with everything, including my fictitious last name. Like, I am no longer walking that path. I'm going to try to walk the more difficult path of my mother. But I don't know. We have now caught up in book knowledge to each other.
Yeah, totally.
There's no more mildly interesting things left to talk about. I will say that, like, I'm halfway through another science fiction book right now, Truth of the Divine. I'm going to immediately start the next book after this. Yeah. I've already got it reserved in the Cincinnati Public Library system.
Oh shit, I'm going to be behind.
I'm a couple spots ahead of you, fucker. I'm going to hoard them. I'm going to get multiple Kindles, check them all.
The $23 to go buy this thing. It's cool.
I'm going to watch it again and see. I hope I didn't come across as too negative. I think this was mostly good. It's just there was a few things that I felt like they tried to divert when they should have kind of just kept going straight forward. And if they'd done that or given this episode more time to breathe, it'd have been a perfect finale. Because I guess that's I'm always trying to chase the finale of Leftovers, the finale of Star Trek The Next Generation. That's the first one I remember as a kid, like, thinking, holy shit, how satisfying is this?
Right.
It's everything I want from it. It wasn't that, but it was pretty damn close. And overall, when I think about this as season, what they had to do with how little they had, it's amazing. And when I think of the series as a whole, it's still... I think, I mean, maybe I have some more residual affection for Star Trek The Next Generation, but like, I think this is the best science fiction series I've ever seen. This is the Lord of the Rings for science fiction. This is my new benchmark for what audiovisual storytelling in the far-flung future with aliens and shit can look like. Everything like this is this is adult entertainment.
Yeah, it's that, and it's serious entertainment. It's to the point where I don't think I will look back on this in 10 years the way I look back on like a Battlestar Galactica. And I loved Battlestar Galactica.
Sure.
Every moment I was riveted to the very end.
Right.
But I look back on it and go, that was a little melodramatic. It's a little soap opera-y. Yeah. The love stuff. Yeah. Boy, they really leaned into that off with the Starbuck and Apollo stuff. I think this series, looking back on it, will be more fondly remembered, held in higher esteem than something by Battlestar Galactica.
I hope this becomes like the fucking Wire, where like, you know, no one watched The Wire when it first came out. 20 years later, everyone has seen The Wire, and it's had huge, like, and it would be great if it would have like starts conversations the same way The Wire did about addiction, about how we feel about late stage capitalism, about how we feel about corruption in our institutions. Like, I would love for The Expanse to like, 20 years from now, influence the way people think about, you know, how we take care of the planet together, our mutual obligations to each other, how we engage in foreign diplomacy and foreign policy. Mm-hmm. I would love for that to happen. And I, you know, also would love to see another series. And we have a much better chance if this show continues to grow in people's estimations.
If they do another one, we do an award show called The Baldies every year.
It's coming out in March this year.
We always have a risk versus reward category. Like, how risky was this project versus like the potential payoff? That's going to be in that category because they've ended this so well.
Yeah.
And it does feel final in a way that I would be happy going out on this note.
Yeah.
Because if they were to bring it back, then they have to hit that note all over again. And that's going to be even harder, I think.
And I hear that it is. Because, like, I think that, like, everything I've heard is the next series expands upon The Expanse in exactly the same scope and magnitude as
the Ring Gate opening.
As a Ring Gate opening. And to me, that says those precursors come back. The Ring Gate entities do wake. And, you know, Laconia has access to that technology, and it's going to be just another big shit show. Only now, instead of you've also got aliens into the mix. It's just going to be like essentially Star Wars, and that is going to be that's an ambitious story to tell, and they're going to need a bigger budget. And I hope they get it.
It feels like Amos falling to the Ring Gate or to the nucleus, with all this flack going on around him. And you did that once successfully. You landed. Do it again, the outcome might...
That's true.
You might get hit by a piece of shrapnel and you're done. And it's just so risky to do it again. That said, I would welcome it.
Let me ask you this. As a fan of The Expanse, would you rather them try another series and get canceled after one season or one series? Or would you rather them never try?
If they're going to do it, I want like a three-year contract that makes all makes the rest of the story happen.
I think it should be all or nothing, because that would almost be worse than you know. But on the end, I'm trying to think of like, would I have rather The Expanse got canceled after one season than never have seen it at all?
Or well, I mean,
although I gotta say The Expanse wasn't The Expanse in season one.
Like, yeah, I would it if it got canceled at the end of season four, would you have been satisfied, right? Because that is the direct analog.
And also that
it was
canceled,
got renewed.
That was the end of a story. Like, you could have done it there.
But it makes season four feel like a why.
Like a bonus feature. Yeah. Like a reunion.
One ship.
Yeah.
like an extended one ship. Yeah.
It's tough. Would I rather have more of something? What I really would hate is if this turns into another production company with a new cast and new crew and they just like fuck it up. Sure. Like, if it's one thing to see a season seven that's as good as this and it just like doesn't, because like people don't, the appetite for really realistic political intrigue in the 24th century doesn't exist. And also, like, is that, I also want to know if like, maybe this was like the magnum opus and then the next trilogy is just like space fantasy. Like, is it going to feel as gritty and grounded when you've got protomolecule shit and you've got protomolecule hybrids and you're going to war with gods? And, like, is that going to feel... Because, like, I like the fact that this so neatly maps into various parts of human history. Mm-hmm. And you can see it, like... Does it get so gonzo that it's a fundamentally different show starting next season? Because
they've reined that stuff in over the last three seasons, right? Like,
right.
Season four was like the height of it, and then it's come down since then.
I'd argue even season three was, where you had the, like, what the hell's going on with... you had the hybrid still a big part of the thing. Well, you had
making the generator, like, yeah, introducing the entities within it and, yeah, like, the generator planets and shit like that. It's...
Miller jacking the exoskeleton. The
inspector,
you're right. That's pretty protomolecule-y. But you're right. It went hard back to just...
It did.
Grounded political intrigue in season five and six.
And I think you're right. If we did blow this back out, they'd have to do a similar arc. They'd have to bring it back in around season seven, right? So, or, season eight.
Yeah. What does that even look like if you're now an 1100 system? Because that's the thing that even... Because we talked about that, like, how exciting it was at the end of season three. They're like, oh my God, humanity's got the star access to the stars.
Yeah.
But they've managed to contain that to where it's still the solar system. I don't know how you do that going forward. Because obviously the trade union is there to not do that. They're there to open up the stars. So
for sure.
Lots of stories left to tell in the universe. I'm curious to see what Dan and Ty feel like. Like, are they going to continue writing short stories, and are they going to open it up to other people to do, like, the George R. R. Martin kind of, like, to start, you know, curating anthologies set in their universe? Like,
I can't imagine any of them being as satisfying as what we've already seen in the mainline, but
it's tough.
I would welcome, like, you know, all the Star Trek books that came out in the 90s or whatever, right? Or the Star Wars books, side tales.
Yeah.
I'd welcome that stuff. Like, give me the Belter stuff. Yeah. Give me a, I don't know, maybe a Christmas in the Belt. What does that look like?
Yeah.
You know?
It's just
give me
creative,
an official version of that.
It's hard. It's like, it's tough to see, like, because, like, imagine, like, the end of Lost, if you're a big Lost fan, like, man, what could Damon Lindelof do better than this? And then you get to the end of The Leftovers, and you think, and then you get to the end of The Watchmen, and it's like... I don't know, man. Some people have a lot of bangers inside of them, and I'm curious to see what these guys come up with going forward.
Some are just natural storytellers, and I think that's what we've got here
with
Dan and Ty. I think, look, those guys, I don't think they told that many stories before this. Mm-hmm. They were hoping to make this thing into an RPG, like a pen and
that's
paper.
That's how it started, as far as I can tell.
Right, and then they were just like, let's blow this out. Let's blow this out into a series of novels, and... They've really stepped up to the plate, I think, as... I don't want to say their first time, because I don't know if that's true. I'm not familiar with their total backstory, but as not already well-respected authors, they've done a hell of a job here, both in the books, which, you know, is basically all them, but then in also adapting it with the help of, you know, Naren Shankar and just a bunch of people behind the scenes. I'm not going to shout them all out, obviously, but just a ton of people working on this show. They've all done such great jobs.
Yeah. Looks like I was just looking real quick that Dan, I guess, has written a bunch of stuff, including some stuff, but like,
Ty, I thought he might have come to Ty and said, like, hey, I've got experience in this. Let's take your RPG idea. Cause he was early in on the RPG stuff, like playing test versions of it or some shit.
Yeah. I guess, Ty was like the GM of the RPG that kind of and that's how they started collaborating. So
yeah.
I would love to see, solo, whether they continue to work together. They seem to have a very good working relationship. And I from what I can tell of their personalities on Twitter and stuff, I feel like I like the guys too. And they're relatively young. They're in their like 50s and 40s. So they've still got a lot of stories to tell. So
yeah.
This is our opinion on how this is ended up and what our thoughts are on the franchise going forward. We are going to have a couple more opportunities. I guess you've missed the live watch opportunity if you're hearing this podcast now. Although I will say that if you want to see what those were all about, twitch.tv/baldmove has the video archives for all of our stuff for up to 60 days. So if you want to see our thoughts on the finale as it was occurring and how the community reacted to it, go to twitch.tv/baldmove. There's a time we put the time code of the episodes on the video stream, so you can easily synchronize it up. And more to the point, early next week, we'll have one final mailbag for The Expanse. We're going to wrap up the series and the season and all that. But that's it for now. ExpanseofBaldMove.com. We'll talk about what your thoughts were next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.